This is Japan Baseball Weekly, the only English podcast covering all 12 NPB teams. And now, your hosts, John E. Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of September 14th. I'm John Gibson, and with me at a decent hour on Sunday night is Jim Allen. What's happening, man?
Oh, I'm fine. And how you doing, man?
Well, I'm not sleepy because it's not that late tonight. Thank goodness. Thank goodness for off days.
Sunday off days are a blessing.
Yes, for both of us. Especially when football season has started tomorrow.
Okay, I'll take your word. No, I thought it started on Thursday, didn't it?
Well, full-fledged.
Oh, like full week, full slate of games.
That was just one opener game. Yeah, that's nothing. Okay. Nothing to see there. Mm-hmm. Okay, and as we always do, a salute to everyone doing their part in the fight against the coronavirus worldwide, on the front lines and everywhere. Thank you. Thank you for masking up. We continue to battle.
Stay vigilant.
Yes, we're battling here. On this week's show, we've got a telephone interview with Matt Moore of the SoftBank Hawks. We're going to talk about what's left of the CL race and a little bit about the PL race. We've got comeback kids or comeback veterans. I don't know what you want to call them. I don't think they're kids. We're going to talk about a big milestone and some other great notes. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so I set up a chat with Matt Moore, and I got a really big assist from yet again from Dennis Sarfate, the great import closer, or the greatest import closer in NPB history. He saved us, so to speak.
For not the first time.
For not the first time, saved us from having to go through the PR, red tape, and all that stuff. So a thousand thank yous to you, Dennis. Matt's a first-year lefty with the Hawks, and you know, he had an injury coming out of camp that kind of slowed him down, but he has come back at a good time for the Hawks because they need starting pitching. So it's a good time for him to be in the rotation and be productive. He picked up his first NPB victory on August 29th, and he's 31. He had Tommy John surgery in 2014, and you know, he had some injuries last year. He spent some time with a number of teams, including the Texas Rangers. Seems like we get a lot of players coming over from the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, it's Texas, you know, there's the Lehigh Valley AAA team and the Texas Rangers and the Reno Aces. I think they have a charter flight to Narita sometimes.
And it sends him right down to the office there to sign contracts at the NPB office in Tokyo. Yeah. So now Matt's father was in the Air Force, as my father was. Hey, Pops. And Matt lived in Okinawa with his family from ages 6 to 10 in the late 90s to the turn of the century. So, you know, living in Okinawa, he had some experience in Japan, and now he's back. So let's take a listen to Matt Moore. All right, Matt Moore of the SoftBank Hawks is our guest this week, and we certainly appreciate it. We're thrilled to have you on the show. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me.
All right, so I think I actually saw your big league debut as a starter. It was September 22nd, 2011, and it was against the Yankees, who are really popular, especially in Japan. So I went and looked up the box score, and like I said, I think I watched the game. So what's the difference in you now as a pitcher than the one who started in that major league debut that day?
Well, maybe 10 extra pounds and, you know, maybe 5 or 6 miles an hour on my fastball.
5 or 6 miles an hour faster?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that was September, so I think I had maybe went down a couple ticks, but earlier in that year I started the year in Double A, and I was sitting about 97, 98. And then, you know, by the time I got to the big leagues, you know, sitting probably 96, 97.
Sure.
And you know, being able to kind of get 98 whenever I wanted to. But, that was my debut starting. I think maybe a week earlier, I had come out of the bullpen in relief for Wade Davis in Baltimore at Camden Yards, and I think Matt Wieters clipped me for a home run, so I didn't feel, you know, all that great coming out of my debut. But, you know, I think that game kind of, you know, reassured a lot of the things that people have been telling me, you know, is, hey, you know, your stuff is going to play, you know, just trust it and attack hitters. And, you know, through five innings, you know, I think I had, you know, 10 or 11 strikeouts or something, and just being able to see those guys that I had watched on TV swing through the same fastball that I had been throwing in Montgomery, Alabama all summer, you know, and then in Durham, you know, really, you know, brought some confidence to me for the rest of that season. And, you know, my coming here to Japan, you know, just in my debut, I guess, you know, in spring training, you know, I had very similar butterflies and nervousness because, you know, the hitter here, you know, maybe not quite as big of swings. So, you know, I didn't know quite how the fastball was going to play, and my approach to pitching was going to work out here. But, yeah, I think, you know, over the last, you know, couple months, I've started to settle in a little bit with, you know, a little tweaked approach to pitching.
Okay, sure. I'm going to ask you about approach as we go along here. But before, I still want to go back to that game because I looked up the box score. And in that game on the field that day were Dan Johnson, who ended up playing with the Yokohama team, Andre Jones, who went to Rakuten, Brandon Laird, who's now with Lotte, and yourself. So how did you end up coming to MPB?
Well, last season, I was with the Detroit Tigers, and you know, I had my first start went pretty well, and my second start I was in the middle of and went to cover first base. Last runner, I think it was Whit Merrifield, you know, hit a ground ball to my first baseman. So I kind of, you know, my momentum's taking me to third base. I go to cover, and something in my knee buckled, and I didn't know exactly what it was. It was the last pitch of the inning. So I wound up trying to throw one more pitch down in the bullpen just to make sure my knee was fine. It didn't actually hurt too bad when it happened.
Right.
And I just kind of collapsed once my leg planted, and that force went through. And I didn't know what was wrong. So long story short, I had a pretty significant tear in my meniscus. Mm-hmm. And it was something that they didn't want to just take it out because the piece was pretty significant size, and you know, I was 29 years old at the time, so they thought it was worth a shot to try to repair it with sutures, and hopefully it took and, you know, would continue to cushion that joint. You know, and so coming back from that injury, it never hurt, you know, but it never quite got the stability back. So I wound up getting another surgery and having the meniscus taken out, and felt great. Still feels fine to this day, and you know, trying to keep things that way. But yeah, the opportunities came up kind of at a pretty unique time in the major league offseason. Seems like you know, the 30 clubs over there have kind of all got on the same page at the same time. So signings happen, you know, more in bunches than they do sporadically, as opposed to maybe 10 or 20 years ago. Teams kind of had their own path. But right now, especially leading up to the Rule 5 draft, is when this offer came from the Hawks. And, you know, I didn't have any guaranteed major league deals on the table at the time. It just wasn't quite the time in the offseason where a player like me coming off injury was going to get those offers. And I didn't really feel like passing up on this, especially SoftBank and the organization that they are and how successful they are. You know, and just asking players that had been there, this sounded like by far the best opportunity I had playing baseball this year.
Right.
And, you know, so far I couldn't be happier with my experience here. You know, the team, the city, you know, how, you know, just how my wife and I are being able to experience a new culture for the first time together. You know, it's really been a blessing for us.
Okay. So you came here as a guy who reached the major leagues and had some success. How much did you feel or get a sense of the expectations that were on your shoulders when you came here?
You know, I didn't really feel like I had any added pressure than the job normally creates just in nature. But, you know, especially to kind of understanding how they're, you know, champions of a few years running now, and, you know, maybe 5 out of 6, if I'm not mistaken.
They win all the time. You guys, they own everything.
Yeah. So, you know, it's really never felt like, you know, I had to kind of come here and be more than I was capable of. So, you know, just trying to look at it from the standpoint that I'm going to try to do the things I do well and do them consistently. And, you know, they have some stars on this team, no doubt. And, you know, I'm just trying to fit in where they need me. And, you know, I think, you know, I had a calf injury that kind of, tested me there a little bit, because it was pretty unfortunate when it happened and how it happened. Never had anything quite like that. But now that we're back, it's been good to get back to the team, especially they've been playing so well. It feels good to be able to, you know, contribute in the right direction.
Yeah, you said that this team has stars. We're very aware of that. We always talk about it on the show, how rich in talent SoftBank is. So, but we've got this unheralded Lotte Marines team, and you faced them last week. What was your takeaway after you went up against them?
Yeah, you know, they're, from what I could see, just not only just in my game, but, you know, they're crafty, they're scrappy. You know, it's some slashes, everybody's trying to steal. You know, they don't give up at bats. They don't forfeit that third strike for a big swing. You know, I thought that they pitched really well. You know, I thought, you know, especially I think they won all 3 games against us here, but that backside of the bullpen was as solid as we had seen, and their starting rotation, you know, really, really was solid, it looked like. So, you know, but from my side of things, you know, their offense, you know, I'd imagine would be even better with Laird still around. But I think Leonis, you know, he's given me trouble in the States in the past. So, yeah, it was definitely a battle that I was going into, you know, on full alert, realizing how well they had been playing and where they are in the standings. But yeah, I thought that they did a lot of things well and put a lot of pressure on us to make plays.
When did you face Leonis and how much?
I don't know how many at bats, but, you know, I faced him when he was with Seattle and I was with Tampa. I faced him when he was with Texas. I faced him in 2018. The last time I faced him in the States, he had a home run off me, knocking out of the game in the 6th or 7th inning on a hanging curveball with 2 strikes. So you know, kind of left a, you know, that sour taste in your mouth. So seeing him here, you know, I knew we had to be careful with certain pitches, and, you know, feel pretty lucky just being able to get out of there with, you know, a couple ground balls and a pop fly. So, right. Yeah, you know, I'll take that.
Let's go.
yeah, I know. And it seems like he's really found a groove here, especially with the power game. And he's been a great talent with just overall, you know, in speed and outfield ability, you know, with that kind of power is something you don't see all the time. So definitely have to take that into account when we're pitching to him with runners on base. And, you know, I thought that they have a good club, and you know, it was, you know, here for the rest of the season, we're going to have to, you know, play some good ball.
All right. Now you touched on it earlier, about your adjustments that you're making in your pitching. I don't know if it's philosophy or approach, but what have you done to try to have success here in Japan?
Well, I think, you know, at first, you know, I kind of had to try to, I wanted to kind of do the things I already did well before, you know, kind of trying to reinvent, you know, my approach or my mix of things. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things for me and most pitchers most likely is just being convicted in everything that you're doing and every pitch that you're making. Is, you know, so trying to find conviction in, you know, 1-0 curveballs or 1-0 changeups. You know, took a little bit of time. You know, I typically like to pitch off my fastball, you know, and at times that won't be the case here. And that, you know, getting in that mindset of believing in that and being convicted in what I'm throwing, even though it goes against, you know, 10 years of me thinking a different way. But the hitter's approach they're unique to what I'm used to. You know, I think baseball back in the States, everybody's kind of okay striking out, you know, and here it just seems like they'd rather do anything but strike out. And that's, you know, that's more like the way that I grew up learning how to play baseball, you know, in high school and college, and that amateur mindset was like, hey, I'm not just going to give up this at bat. I'm going to make you earn this out. I'm going to hit the ball somewhere. I'm going to make you make a play. I'm going to put the pressure on you. You know, and then in the States, it's a lot different, you know.
Yeah, swing hard in case you hit it.
Sure. And, you know, you see, you know, the big fastball on a wipeout pitch. Well, here, you know, I feel like, you know, command is your biggest asset. You know, being able to move the ball around, being able to throw your secondary pitches, not just in the strike zone, but for quality strikes, because these guys, you know, they really battle, you know. So kind of being in the middle of the plate or on the thirds with two strikes isn't going to do you very much. I think, you know, just being able to command those secondary pitches has been something that, you know, I've definitely gotten better at. And then also my convictions and being able to believe in kind of what goes against, you know, my nature. And I feel like I'm a lot better placed than I was a few months ago.
How difficult is it to work with the catchers when you get a new stable of catchers like that and you don't speak the same language and all that stuff and you got different philosophies and you don't even speak the same baseball language in some aspects?
Well, I've been doing most of my pitching to our catcher, Kai. And, I mean, we've had meetings after games. You know, we get back to the hotel, we'll meet for 20, 30 minutes. We've done that a few times. And then, you know, we have 20, 30-minute pitcher meetings before the game. We had all spring training to kind of get familiar with each other. So from a receiving and setup standpoint, I feel very comfortable with Kai from the get-go. And then as we've went along, I've started to understand more of where he comes from in his game calling. Mm-hmm. And I've started to really, you know, find conviction in that and get much more comfortable.
All right. So the last question, this is from my partner, and he says there's a scarcity. I know you touched on it briefly here, but he says there's a scarcity of guys thinking go long or go home. So how do you put away guys who are basically trying to up your pitch count, you know, maybe get it over 101 plate appearance?
Yeah. That's one of the things we talk about in the meetings, because I've only faced, you know, maybe half the teams in the NPB. So I really don't know who's who. And, you know, they'll tell me, hey, this guy really just wants to kind of bleed your pitch count. You know, let's work more, you know, in the heart of the zone, because it's harder to foul off a pitch in the heart of the zone, right, than it is to foul off a borderline strike. You know, you kind of, end of the bat, it's a little bit easier to kind of push, you know, see the ball really deep into the zone and just slap it foul.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so if it's in the middle, if we're kind of more in the heart of the zone, the ball's going to get put in play more. So they've kind of targeted a couple of those players, and, you know, we've been able to just make some good pitches in the bottom half of the middle of the zone and get them to put that in play. And we have between, you know, even me and Makihara and, you know, our infielders up the middle, you know, have been solid and really, you know, bailed me out more than a few times. So kind of target those guys. There definitely seems to be still, you know, some of those big, those boppers. They kind of have that one thing in their mind. But, yeah, I would agree. It does seem like they're far and few between. So most of it just seems like the quality of the pitch. You know, like like I said, you know, I might be able to reach back and get 95 these days on, you know, a good inning, but most of the time I'm doing most of my work at 92, 93. Mm-hmm. And command is going to be my best asset here. You know, it's something that, it's not just quite a matter of being ahead and getting ahead. However, you know, that's the most important thing to me, is just getting ahead every hitter. But, you know, what you do, I guess, before you do wind up getting ahead of those hitters, you know, there still can be a lot of outs, you know, in 2-1, 2-0, 3-1 counts. If you execute those pitches, with quality, you know, and, you know, kind of stay in certain zones that they know that, you know, my catchers and our coaches are telling me, hey, you're going to have more success here than you will with, you know, maybe the fastball up. It typically has been a pretty big weapon for me, and haven't quite got as many bites on it here. So I think play discipline has been something that, you know, has, you know, kind of opened my eyes a little bit. You know, they're not going to quite chase, you know, the wipeout stuff or the heater up mm-hmm. as much. It seems like they let the ball travel into the zone, you know, maybe a little bit deeper, and maybe not try to catch everything out front for the big fly.
Well, it sounds like you've been doing your homework, and we certainly appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you very much, and hopefully we can have you on again before the season's over.
Yeah, sure. I'd like that.
All right. Awesome. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. Thanks again, Matt. Gosh, I can't tell you how nice a guy he was in this whole process. And he must really be a nice guy. I can't wait to meet him and talk to him. A lot of these guys, we keep telling you, we've never met them. This is the first time I ever spoke with him. And we talked, I think, about in total 45 minutes. And it was an off day. He had done his work in the morning. We talked in the afternoon, and he was going to go shopping with his family. He's got a one-year-old son. So, and his wife is pregnant. They're expecting, again, I think he said early next year. So he's got a lot of stuff going. what did you like about the chat?
A whole bunch. I've been kind of intrigued ever since the Hawks announced they were going to sign him. And the timing was interesting. The Hawks, they do a lot of things, you know, interesting in terms of signing. I remember they signed also Rick Vandenhurk about the same time at the winter meetings.
Mm-hmm. You mean same time of year, yeah.
Pardon?
Same time of year?
Yeah, well, it was about the same time, yes. I mean, the same time of the year, exactly. It's in early December because the Rule 5 draft is the last day of the winter meetings. So it is interesting, and it sort of rang, I could hear bells ringing because the market is different. The market is changing, as Adam Jones mentioned a few weeks ago. And I'm glad, you know, the Hawks seem to be as tuned into that as anybody else. So that was interesting. But three things really caught my eye, or my ear, I suppose. And one is talking about the transition from AA to the majors. Mm-hmm. Because he made it sound almost effortless. And it's really hard. And one reason it's really hard, and this is something I didn't know until about the last year and a half, is that the AAA, the minor league ball, used to be like the Japanese ball.
A little smaller and different.
Well, different, tackier, and, you know, less polished, less smooth.
So just different, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, more irregular. And that, I remember Chris Martin told me that. He said, you know, when you get to, if you're one of these guys who doesn't get a lot of playing time in the major leagues, you're having to always adapt to having a different ball, and then you're being judged based on what you're doing with a ball that you haven't thrown in maybe a month.
Gotcha.
And so it's always really hard to stick as a pitcher in a, you know, with somebody, especially if they don't know that you're a starter or a reliever, as it was in this case. But it was interesting to me that he found that transition to be very relatively easy. And I think that's probably because he was more of a fastball pitcher, where that is going to be less of a challenge. But anyway, mm-hmm. that was interesting to me, and perhaps it smoothed his transition. And the next thing was the Marines. I thought that was interesting too, because the Marines, again, you know, he's only seen the Marines when they're playing the Hawks. And my perception of the Marines is that they kind of have a flip a switch when they play the Hawks.
The we think we own you switch.
I don't know what it is, but it's a intensity gear and a preparation gear. And I don't want to say they look past the other teams, but it's almost like they use the Hawks to prepare for the rest of the league. Okay, if we get it right against the Hawks, we can get it. We can beat anybody, kind of thing.
Okay.
And so they seem to want to do, they seem to do their best against the Hawks. They seem to have the best, their best at bats. They seem to execute their pitches better. They seem to be better prepared for the Hawks than for anybody else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true or not, but that is my impression. The thing I think the most about is, and going back to his transition to the majors, he made this transition to Japan, and I thought he explained it really, really well, or at least, you know, he explained it in a way which was very methodical.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was sort of three parts. Basically, the process works like this. Number one is, how is it going to play? Number two is, what do I do to make my stuff play? What do I need to do to improve? What do I need to improve? In his case, it was the command of his secondary pitches. And number three, which goes back to the first thing he said about going to the majors, which is, trust your stuff and attack hitters.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was really the meat of this sandwich. I'm sorry for you vegans. But
yeah. You don't sound sorry. In fact, wipe that mayonnaise off your face.
I'm just reaching out to you all. Okay.
Wipe that mayonnaise off your face when you say that.
Sorry, I got a little grease on my chin. But the whole point is that everything is about believing in what you're doing.
Mm.
You know, and he mentioned, this is something which I found really fascinating. You're talking about conviction of every pitch, and
oh yeah, that was one of mine. Yeah,
and believing in what you're doing, even when you don't really, it doesn't match your expectations and your understanding of what you are as a competitor, but
correct,
knowing that this is what I need to do to compete, and believing, you know, and sort of suspending disbelief and going all in. That was mm-hmm. really interesting. And then, of course, the finishing touch on that is learning to trust the catcher and his input in how it works
right.
with your stuff, you know, mm-hmm. and building on that foundation of belief. I found that all quite riveting.
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed the entire chat as well. And for me, it was the backdoor slider when he told us, it was actually on your question, which is, I didn't actually want to bring up this point because I thought you would bring it up because it was on your question. But when I asked him about, you know, trying to put away guys, and he said, yeah, you know, the team, we've sat down and they've identified the hitters who are mm-hmm. trying to drive up pitch counts on opposing teams. So we've been doing this podcast, what, 9+ years?
Yep.
And we surpassed 400 episodes, I don't know, maybe a month or two back. So we didn't have any fanfare about it. But I know we've talked to a lot of pitchers, and I don't think we've had anyone on the show explain it quite that way.
Yep.
That there are guys out there who are stepping into the batter's box with the very sole purpose of making you work hard. They're going to take a couple of strikes, or maybe one strike or a borderline pitch, and they're just trying to get the bat on some of these other pitches and just drive you nuts, especially if you're going to be up there throwing off-speed pitches, which they can normally, if they're sitting on it or if they're expecting it, they can get a better idea of how to get the bat on it, even if they can't put it into play. But, you know, that just seemed to me that we haven't heard that kind of thing on the show before. I can't say that because my brain, you know, I'm getting older. The guy Coaster Freak on Twitter, he has a brain like a database. He remembers things that I said 10 years ago when we started this show that I've forgotten. And he seems to be able to go back into his brain and with the retrieval system that he has and dig it out. So
I got listeners and readers who remember stuff I never said or wrote.
# I hate.
How's that?
That, yeah. Yeah, well, maybe we'll talk about something like that next week for me. But anyway.
No, but what you're saying, people, we have had that, although you know.
I just haven't heard them explain it quite that way. I mean, I've had them. We've heard them say some of these left-handed batters, they're just trying to serve the ball in the left field. And if you throw X pitch, you know, if you throw off-speed pitches on the outside part of the plate, they just either are looking to flip them in the left field.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're throwing a two-seamer to a left-hander, they're just trying to flip it over there. And sometimes they end up foul. But we haven't heard them say that there are a couple guys or they're specific players on teams who are out there just trying to drive your pitch count up. I don't remember that.
No, I talk about it, that thing so much with the pitchers, and it's sort of like, yes. I even mentioned that today to Carlos Mirabal. We had a live event on jballallen.com, and Carlos Mirabal, the former Fighters pitcher, joined us, and we were talking about that, and he's going, man, oh man. And I asked him the same question. But the answer that Matt gave that I loved, and I guess I should have picked on it, but was, how do you get rid of them? Was you work them in the middle of the plate and you make them hit the ball fair.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, he's like, here, look, I know you're up here messing around. I don't care if you get a single. Just put the ball in play and get the next man up. Get out of my face.
as an aside, and we were joking about this one today with Carlos. Now there's a Lotte Marines coach, Yusuke Torigoi, and he started his career with the Dragons, and he was one of the guys. He was one of the guys who got arrested for tax evasion.
Mm-hmm. I went to the court hearing when he had to walk up, and we got that walk up photo. You know, the ones that all the TV and camera crews always get.
Okay, so he went to the Hawks, and when he was with the Hawks, and he was a right-handed hitter. He used to do that. He used to, you know, foul everything off and run up guys' pitch counts. And one day I was watching a game on TV from Fukuoka, and the Kintetsu Buffaloes were playing the Hawks, and Jeremy Powell was pitching against him for the Kintetsu Buffaloes, and he was just trying to he was throwing stuff low in the zone, and he got a comebacker on, you know, he fell off the mound to the left side, and he fielded a comebacker between first and the mound.
Mm-hmm.
And he went over to make the tag, except it was more like a kind of a rolling block tackle.
Excuse me.
And I asked him about that because I was incensed. I was thinking, like, man, what did he do to you? And he says, like, that guy just drives me mad. So I think there was some more colorful language in that, but the point was,
like, we got the Disney version of that.
Don't be messing around with my pitch count, dude.
Yeah, we obviously got the Disney version of that, but yeah, I like that. And just like you said, the conviction part where he's talking about how he is making basically that mental adjustment of, I can't remember who we had on the show before, but they said, look, your job is to take yourself out of the equation. So you're just a tool to get a job done. And so to get that job done, you've got to throw these particular pitches in this particular situation. And that's what we're going to call. So, but you, part of that with a pitcher is you have to believe and you have to go out and try to execute the pitch to the best of your ability. So, you know, I think we've heard pitchers refer to this or touch upon this in the past, but just not quite in the way that Matt expresses it. You're right. I like the way he gives a thorough explanation of his thought process and how things are going and in his head and how he arrives at, you know, getting there. You know, the secondary pitches, I don't know that he said, he just said they weren't quite good enough, I guess, mm-hmm. and getting it over the plate isn't good enough. Whereas sometimes in the States, when you know guys are sitting dead red, as I like to say, and looking for fastballs, you can throw a ball or pitch, not maybe center cut, but you can just throw it over the plate. And a lot of times they're not looking for it. They either take it or maybe swing it. Or as he said, I think he said the same thing about, I don't think this was in our chat there. It was in our after discussion, but he was talking about plate coverage in the States too. And he was telling me that guys don't have really good plate coverage on both sides of the plate in the state. So I'm going to have to start believing that, although it's still hard to fathom in the major leagues. But so if you're, you hit an inside part of the plate when somebody's looking away, then maybe it's possible you could get them. But anyway, you need to locate those pitches, and they need to be quality pitches. And, I really liked how he talked about that and just discussed it. And I found it really enlightening here in our 10th year of doing the show. I just like the way he went about explaining everything.
Yeah, I thought it was methodical. It sort of reminds me of the way he pitched, which is very stable. He has a very stable base when he works. He's a big, strong guy.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like he's overthrowing or exerting too much effort. It looks like he could pitch all night if he needed to.
I was interested because the first or second time I saw him pitch, the announcers, the analyst was saying, whoever was catching him that day, I'm sure it was Takuya Kai, but against a lot of hitters, he was starting him on the edge. And I thought, as the announcer, as the analyst did, that his stuff is going to play in the zone and that he's better off attacking people in the zone, and then working outwards. And I think that was also maybe his, I don't know. There are other issues, obviously, because command is not always everything and is not always there. And there are other issues at play. They may want to be mixing things up, but I remember that. And I remember him, when I heard his comments, and I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, for him, it's all about, and the comment I would make is it's not always about it being in the zone. As he said, quality pitches in the zone are really important because you're going to be in the zone. You don't want a straight fastball in the zone unless the guy's, decided that the pitch is coming is going to be a curveball and that's what he's going to crush. Otherwise, you're in trouble. But if you've got a well-executed fastball and it's got a lot of spin on it, then you can be in the zone. You can pretty much live in the zone as long as you throw something else sometimes.
Right.
But, it's all about where it is all about, as he said, it is all about command and, and executing your pitches. And for that, the conviction is a key. You can't do stuff well half, I'm sure some people can. I'm sure some people have enough talent they can do things halfway and still be really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's too hard.
Yeah.
I mean, baseball, that was the thing Zach Neal pointed out the first time we talked was, I don't think it was on the podcast, but baseball is really easy to fail at. It's really hard, at any level. You can fail at single A if you, blink. Guys who are major leaguers could fail at double A if they don't give it their full attention. So Japan ain't easy. Single A, pro baseball isn't easy. And that whole the idea of conviction on every pitch and training yourself to be convicted that every pitch can count and every pitch has a purpose was really cool.
Yep. Yep. All right, let's transition into talking about the SoftBank Hawks. They are still in first place by a game. As we speak, there are games on Monday, so things could change. I believe the second place Chiba Lotte Marines are playing on Monday.
And as so, are Eagles.
Yeah, that could be a half game difference by the time you guys hear this, or it could be more depending on what day of the week that you're listening. But anyway, there are games as of Monday when we were uploading the show. So, SoftBank has struggled a little bit this year. It's really clinging to this first place situation. But the team has got its Cuban connection back with Alfredo Despaña, who clubbed a pair of home runs and drove in four on Wednesday in an 8-2 win at Sendai to beat the Eagles. And then Yurisbel Graciel, who started off a little bit slowly when he returned, including defensively, but he's starting to delivering some big blows, especially those uppercuts when he gets those home runs, the ones in front of the bench in the celebration. I like those.
Yeah, well, Hiroaki Takaya got his yesterday, so.
And one of my favorite players in PB since I saw him try to, tear the cover off a ball with a bat a long time ago has been Yuki Yanagita. But there's a site that has some interesting stats that I use as a reference, and one of the stats is called clutch or outstanding performance rating. And what that does is it just ranks or it counts the number of times that you get a hit that scores the first run of the game or the tying run in a game or a tie-breaking run, a go-ahead run, or anything that results in the winning run. That could be a walk, a bases loaded walk, bases loaded hit by pitch, or a sacrifice.
Are we only talking about RBIs?
Only in this case, we're talking about something that drives in a run. So only RBIs. Yeah. That's okay. Correct. Well, yeah. And it doesn't even have to be hit. It could be a ground ball as well.
Okay.
So who do you think leads Japan in those types of hits?
I have no idea.
Yuki Yanagita, come on. I did the opening for you.
Objectively, I don't know. I suspected you were setting me up for that, but I didn't know.
Well, don't suspect. Just listen.
I'm just being totally KY, so give me a break.
They're totally KY. I think you're going to have to explain that because that is a gel back home that...
okay. Oh, you're too slick for me, Gibson.
Hashtag high heat.
KY is a Japanese expression, means you're not reading the room.
Okay. All right. And those are the words start with K and Y. So anyway, Yuki Yanagita, as of the last update of this page that I'm hoping is today on Sunday, has 22 such hits. And
so 22 times he either tied it or put his team ahead.
Or anything that results in the winning run, which doesn't necessarily, because the winning run, the way they figure it in Japan, is the one that makes the difference. So, for example, I think the Dragons won tonight. They won by a score 3-2. That was the final, but Yosuke Hirata had a solo home run. And that put him up 3-1. That ended up being the difference. So
Because they do that soccer style. That would, in soccer language, that would be the winner.
Okay. Right. So it's the winner. So, I mean, you know, with Yanagita leading the way, the Hawks look good, but they've had some struggles this season. They're obviously struggling with the Lotte Marines, as you mentioned earlier. The rotation is all weird with the guys who have come in, out. I don't even know where some of the guys are, if they're supposed to be throwing. You mentioned Rick Vandenhert earlier. Don't know when we're going to see him again. Mm. It's just Kenta Imamiya, their shortstop, yep, got injured. He has been out for a while. There have been a number of guys playing. I mean, in those middle infield positions, and you just don't know what the lineup's going to look like one day. And the guys are out there. They're doing a good job. It's not that they're not doing a good job. I think Imamiya is just kind of a dynamic player defensively and offensively. And I think they miss that. Obviously they miss his glove, but I think he wasn't hitting all that high for average this year, but he's like I said, a dynamic player. He can get you what you need sometimes, even in that little package. He's just a dynamo. So, what are you seeing out of the Hawks? I see at least the defense normally. Now, that's, you know, we had Alfredo Despaigne. He's not going to kill him in the outfield. He's not going to, as someone once said to me, kick the ball over the fence by mistake. But he's not a super outfielder.
No.
And Graciel hasn't been a super outfielder as well. So defensively, I think if anything is going to fail them, it's going to be that down the stretch as they're trying to hold off the, what did we call them? What did Matt call them? The scrappy Marines. That's the key word.
The scrappy, crafty Marines.
Yes.
Maybe he knows somebody they were discussing today, the craft beer selection. So maybe it's the crafty Marines. I don't know. Craft beer, crafty Marines. I don't know. But yeah, the outfield, the defense in left field is, they have an all glove team that they put out there.
Mm-hmm.
The expanded rosters for the pandemic they have 26 active players every day, and they can keep five active players, off of the daily roster. So they can have a little more speed or a little more relief pitching than they normally do at their option.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hawks are a fast team. I mean, they've got some older guys, but Seiichi Uchikawa is not on the first team. In fact, I've heard that other teams in Japan, and I believe Central League teams in particular, are saying, if you're not going to use them, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they got that guy, you know, he's still gathering dust in the minors, and, you know, we could use him.
Yeah.
So they've got a lot of team speed, and they do have a glove team that they put out, and they keep manager Kimiyasu Kudo pretty much rotates his left and right fielders and second baseman and shortstops. So he's got a different look all the time. He's got everybody getting a lot of playing time. But yeah, those guys aren't big hitters. And so to have left field for Gracial or Alfredo De España is a luxury. And as I would said, I think Gracial, when he's is a little more athletic, or he appears a little more athletic. I don't think he's as good an outfielder in some ways. I don't think he's as good at catching the ball as De España is. De España is much slower, but I think he's a little, he seems to have just better better fielding judgment. He seems to know to be in the right place. Maybe it's from a career being slow. You know, I mean, he seems to like, you know, he sees the ball going over his head. You know, he looks at it. He judges it. He knows where it's going to come off the wall. And we saw that in the Japan series. Okay, he gave up a couple of hits because he couldn't get to the ball. But they weren't you know, he didn't give up, didn't play singles into doubles or, you know, or triples or anything. So I like him out there. I mean, Vladimir Valentin is also not healthy. He's a guy you mentioned. You didn't mention.
I didn't mention, yeah.
So there's lots of things they're missing, but they're a good team. And the other thing the Hawks are is they're very well prepared for games. And I think this is the one thing I would mention that, you know, when I watched them play the Lions this weekend, what I saw is the Hawks will basically wear down pitchers with hitting, you know, just good swings. I mean, good swings on good pitches.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to make enough good contact on pitches really that shouldn't be hit that
right.
Sometimes they're going to get a run. They scratched out a run on Saturday against Sean Nolan on two balls that were really, they were pretty good pitches, but one's a double and one's a single. And then, you know, then there's a mistake and there's another mistake and it's a 6-run inning.
Yep.
So.
And Sean's out there in shock.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw him do that twice and it was the same on Friday. It was like Zach Neal. Oh, good pitch. Hit, ball through. Okay. Now a mistake. Bam. And now we're losing. So.
Yep.
That's really what they do. They do it really well. They just wear people down. And so on Sunday, they lost 1-0, but it was kind of like a game where the bounces didn't go their way. You know, they did the same thing. They made good swings. They hit some mistakes, but they just weren't able to get enough breaks, enough of the time, you know, to do damage against a guy who had a very good fastball in the strike zone.
Yep. But up until yesterday, they had won 5 in a row, and they have to, as we make a seamless transition and talk about the Pacific League race, that's basically the only race that's out there because the Giants are putting people away. They're hiding bodies.
Wow.
So to speak.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, come on. I declared that race over last week, but it was probably over.
Well, that's all right, because your opinion is the only one that matters.
No, it's the only one that matters to you.
Well, we're not married, you know.
Like, thank goodness, because
I know.
I don't think I like the way you wash your dishes.
I can see the knife from here, dude.
But anyway, the PLs, it looks like a three-way battle for those two playoff spots. And as most of you remember, probably, this year being the Corona season, only the first two teams will go to a playoff series that will be three games. And it's a tight race. It looks like it's going to be a nice tight race. But the Lions, I think, took a hit. And that's why I'm saying it's a three-way battle. Yeah, they lost 2 out of 3 in Fukuoka. And I wouldn't say it killed off their chances. But what are we in? We're 75, about 75 games through a 120 game season. Really, really a bad spot if you're as far out as the Lions are. And 9.5 games out of first, 8.5 out of second place. That's tough. That is really tough to overcome here. But yeah, it's not unrealistic. I just think they're going to have to start winning more regularly, and they're going to have to stop losing 2 out of 3 to the top team or the second place team. They can't afford to not win series, although I'm sure it's going to happen. But the Marines, I'm looking at their a couple of stats. One is the fact that they have the best quality start percentage in the Pacific League at 48. Well, let's call it 49%, round up a little bit. And I think early on, I think I kept saying, look, I like the back half of their rotation because it's not really just as strong as the front end of the rotation, the drop-off isn't as far as other teams. And they've had some different guys come into the rotation and some go out, but they still have kept up that quality that when you're facing their fifth or sixth starter, you're still going to get a really well-pitched game and chances are a quality start. I keep being surprised. I was one of the few who had them finishing in the playoffs, but I didn't expect this.
I like the Marines. I mean, there's still a team without a star, although Lanis Martin has sort of become the star.
Mm.
He's still a wild card. You know, he's a low average, high voltage player.
Yep.
With that arm that can kill you, and you know he's got that double. He's a double edged sword in the outfield. He can get to balls. He can make these amazing throws. Sometimes the throws go into the seats.
And then sometimes they just get, you know, average runners.
Yeah.
Even with the 2-out single tonight.
Sure.
Mr. Masataka Yoshida is trying to score from second on a 2-out single to right.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Just tuck it in at third.
Yeah. So, so that's fun. That's kind of the revelation. And the other revelation is, I think call on the middle of the rotation. I'll call it. There really isn't a back of the rotation because defining the back of any team's rotation this year is kind of a lost cause because of all the bullpen days. You know, it sort of bleeds into gray. Instead of six guys, it's five guys and the extras from Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, but I think theirs has been the most steady of any team.
Well, right now, I guess Yuta Omine is the back.
Yeah, and that's probably not so good.
Yeah, he's coming off Tommy John surgery. But having said that, Toshiya Nakamura has had some spectacular games. Kota Futaki's had a couple of spectacular games. Kazuya Ojima's had some spectacular games. Ayumu Ishikawa has been very, you know, after a little bit of a rocky start, he's picked up about where he was last year, which is dependable, which was nice because he went from being just an amazing talent to being a guy you didn't really want to be at a party with.
You know, it's like one way to put it.
Man, there's a dark cloud emerging. You know, he just, everything went wrong for that guy after 2017. So he's got it back together. So, yeah, the rotation is really the star of that team. Right now, I know that, or at least the other day, is Tatsuhiro Tamura, their catcher, was hurt on a little bumped runner. And I think he broke a finger.
That's correct. Trying to bunt, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a big loss for them, but because he's one of those catchers who can kind of do everything. I mean, he's a decent offensive player. He's a good defender. He's a smart player, smart base runner. a guy who can really beat you. He's sort of like Yutaro Umeno of the Hanshin Tigers. He's kind of a slightly lighter, less powerful version of that.
Right.
But, you know, a very valuable piece on a team that really needs a lot of valuable pieces because they do lack the superstar.
Yep.
But
yep.
Yeah, they're going to be fun. They're a fun team to watch, and I'm enjoying them more than I have in probably about 6 or 7 years.
Good. And the Eagles remain basically, they're 6.5 out of first. They remain in the hunt, let's put it. So should be fun. Let's make a four-seam transition and talk about Tatsunori Hara, the Giants manager, who with a 2-1 victory over the Yakult Swallows on Friday, earned victory number 1,067, and that put him past legendary skipper Tetsuharu Kawakami for most in club history. And Kawakami was the skipper of the V9 Giants that won 9 consecutive titles. So it's an incredible achievement for him, not only for him, who this is a guy who's in his third stint with the team as manager. So he had one stint. I was there when he returned for stint number 2, then he left and they brought him back. Each time they keep dragging him back, right?
Yeah.
He can't escape.
Yeah, that's right. He's going to be ready for Godfather 3 part 2.
3.2 maybe.
3.2, yeah.
But I love, they had a ceremony for him, and I love what he said afterward or during the ceremony, which was basically that he said he didn't have time to bask at this moment because his peers wouldn't let him. And I thought that was profound because he doesn't normally get emotional or talk about things. He has passed a number of milestones along this journey that he is going through as a really top manager in that. What you brought up, I think it was about 4 years ago, maybe 5, when you said he is one of the managers who's basically helped develop players, more players at the top level than anybody else or any of his peers in NPB at that time. And I've been watching that. I've been watching him put young players into positions in leverage situations or just in late game situations when it's not even that close, either they were losing by a lot or winning by a lot, but just to get them on the field, just to get them used to what's going on. And the one story I have about Hara is when he took over that second time, so it was 2006, I think that was the year after the disaster season when they had Tsuneo Horiuchi was
booed off the field at Fan Appreciation Day.
Yeah, and he was the manager, and they had the all-slugger lineup, and they finished dead last, and
I finished fifth, I think.
Okay. All right. I'll look it up as we talk. But he, I went to his introductory presser, which was, I think it had limited press. So obviously the Yomiuri people were there, so I was able to go. But I would go to a lot of the games that year, but I never really asked any questions. They didn't finish last in 2005. They finished in fifth. And it was 2006. Hara, they finished in fourth place. So it was the next year, 2007, when the Giants were actually going on to win. And they had the lead late, and I can't remember if it was the Tigers or it probably was the Dragons, I think, who were pretty close. And the Giants were involved in a pennant race, and Hara saw me in his little the back room interview room, and he said, "What does the Daily Yomiuri?" Because that was the name of the paper at the time. What does the Daily Yomiuri want to ask tonight? He put me on the spot, and I'm like, "What?
What?
I'm just here to listen, man." So I asked a really I asked a really silly question. I said, "Well, you won tonight, and I think the Tigers won tonight, so there really wasn't anything that that changed. But how important is it to win?" Something stupid, something like that. And he's like, "Oh yeah, that's what everybody wants to know." And because we didn't cover them on a daily basis, I didn't have a question for them that was relevant, but I didn't want to say, "No, I don't have any questions." So that's the one thing I remember about him. So
that's interesting. Put you on a spot. That was Masataka Nashida's favorite thing with me.
In the pressers in front of everybody?
In the pregame pressers, no. He liked to sort of like wait until I wasn't paying attention and then say,
hey,
say,
you.
Say, Jim-san, how is it in America? And I'm thinking like what? Do we put Philadelphia cream cheese? I had no idea what he was. I wasn't listening.
But I wasn't listening.
He would do that particularly just to sort of point out that I was taking up space and not doing anything.
There you go. So anyway, for Hada on this pace, I think he'll pass Seiichi Hoshino is next up on the list. And Hoshino has 1,181 wins. Hada has to get a few more.
Yep, correct.
Yep. Yeah, Hada has to get a few more wins this year, and then maybe a 70-plus win season next year. We'll do it late in the season in 2021. He can pass Hoshino, the late, great Seiichi Hoshino.
Yeah, it's and Hara's – well, Hara's 62. He's actually looking 62 now.
Yeah, suddenly, because they brought him back for a third stint.
Well, he was – yeah, well, he's basically he first managed in 2002. They wanted him to manage before that, but he said, no, I haven't coached. And so he coached for a couple of years for Nagashima. And then in Nagashima stepped down after kind of a disastrous 2001 season. And then the Giants gave him the reins in 2002. And it was funny because I remember at that press conference, Nagashima sort of said, I apologize for giving this lousy team. You know, we're all banged up and hurt and we're not going anywhere. So, you know, good luck with it.
Thanks, bro.
well, you know, there were a lot of things that were kind of like, they were banged up in 2001, but they weren't in 2002. Guys got healthy. Shinosuke Abe became Shinosuke Abe. And yeah, so, and then they swept the Japan series. So that was fun. But after 2003, after they won the Japan series in 2003, they were in danger of losing the pennant race fairly, being knocked out in like the beginning of September. And every day in the newspaper, the former owner, now he's the honorary owner emeritus, Tsuneo Watanabe, affectionately or unaffectionately known as Nabetsune in Japan, was basically, reporters will follow him for dinner and he's got a big mouth and he says he's really quick-witted and he says things, but when he's drunk, he tends to rant.
This is Watanabe.
Watanabe, not Hara. I don't know about Hara's drinking habits. And he would rant and the next day would be full of his rants about Tatsunori Hara in the paper. And after about 2 weeks of reading that, if he doesn't win today, one more loss and he's fired, you know, all the papers had it in the next morning, all the sports papers.
Mm-hmm.
And Hara, the day the Giants were formally eliminated from contention, he said, I'm out. He didn't say, you know, the owner's a jerk. I'm tired of this stuff. I don't need it.
Careful there. Yeah.
He didn't say any of that. He said, I'm out. I've had it. I'm good. And the Giants owner then blamed the reporters for reporting what he said at the press conference.
Yep.
And he said, how dare you? You're the ones who cost us our manager. Because you reported what I said. Jeez, some things in the
world. Truth news.
Yeah, I know. You're on tape saying it. Well, but I didn't say what I said on tape. Okay. So anyway, so he quit. And then the next guy was a disaster. So they decided, okay, we'll bring him back and, you know, and let him have a free reign. And he really had a free reign. And he completely changed the Giants. And then he kind of got tired. You know, you could see things were not. He was kind of getting worn down by the job. And then 2014, they won the pennant, but they lost in the playoffs to the Hanshin Tigers. And they didn't go to the Japan Series. And in 2015, they lost in the first round of the playoffs. Or like, I don't know that. They lost in the playoffs again. And he said, look, I'm good.
Yeah.
And he quit. For the second time, he quit. And he quit for 3 years this time before they dragged him back.
Right.
So,
right.
But he's a quite amazing manager. I think the bit about his raising the talent base is really the key to his success. He's done other things. I know the other one, you know, Alex Ramirez has pointed out that he's exceptionally good at one run strategies, and I've talked about that a little bit on my blog the other day, in a blog post. But I think what it is, he's extremely well, even though he does really kind of strange tactical, he makes a lot of very peculiar tactical decisions. He always had. He's a typical Japanese fanatic believer in platoon advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll take a pretty good right-handed hitter and switch him out for a left-handed hitter who's like not nearly as good because he's got a platoon advantage, because it's what Japanese managers do, and he's pretty religious about that.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, the thing that he does really well is he's really well organized. He has a battle plan. I mean, he knows that in this situation, this is what I'm going to do. In this situation, this is what I'm going to do. And this is the situation we want to do this. And I think that's really the key to his success. He's organized, and he's willing to give untried players. He doesn't get down on when untried players fail, and he'll give them more chances if he thinks they've got something. So I think that's huge. That's very un-Yomiuri Giants. So congratulations to Tatsunori Hara. We're big fans.
Yeah, he's not stopping here. He's going to climb the list and climb the list. So,
yeah.
And in a sort of related note, one player was Sawamura awarded. And what I mean by that, if you can see what I was getting.
Yeah, so the Giants decided to issue their own Sawamura award this week.
Right. Hirokazu Sawamura was awarded his freedom. and that was never more evident than the huge smile I saw on his face on day one when he was with his new team, the Marines. So they sent him, he's 32, they sent him to the Marines for 24-year-old outfielder Kazuya Katsuki. And this was on Monday, and the MPB website said the transaction was official on Tuesday, so that's what we have to go with. And Sawamura, looking up his record, he was 48-50 with the Giants, with 74 saves, 53 holds, a career 2.79 ERA, four shutouts, 12 complete games. So he started out basically as a starting pitcher and then was moved to the bullpen. And yeah, he has just really gone through a lot with this team and just looking for a permanent role, but he hasn't gotten one. He's 48-50 lifetime, 74 saves, 53 holds, 2.79 ERA. He has four shutouts, 12 complete games. But yeah, he's been in different roles this season as well. He's had bullpen roles. He's had at least one start that I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just has been all over the place. So they sent him away, and like I had never really seen him smile, not even after he had pitched. I don't remember it. I probably have seen him smile, but it didn't look like the smile he had, like I said, on day one of being with the Lotte Marines. So he was awarded his freedom, is what I say.
Yeah, he was glowing, and he was the key thing about this trade is it's probably they traded a guy who has been useful in the past, who has had issues with executing his pitches, throwing bad pitches in bad locations.
Yeah, he's just been wild.
He's been inconsistent, and he's been inconsistent for a while. He's had up days and up times. He was successful. He was very successful moving into the closer role. He's all a guy who always gave up a lot of home runs. I mean, he was giving up a lot of home runs when they deadened the ball in 2011.
Take that.
I know. It was not, but and that's always been his thing. You know, he would miss his splitter up in the zone. It would hang up there and people would hit it out. At Tokyo Dome was a good place for that. So he's always had that issue, but he's got other things going for him. And the Giants took a guy who's been very effective. Okay, he's on the downside of his career, but he has been very effective in the past on occasion. He's been occasionally effective the last couple of years when they've sort of used him and not used him. He played in, you know, he played 13 games this year, which is not a lot. He pitched in 43 games last year, so he was a kind of a moderate. He wasn't a frontline reliever. He wasn't the eighth inning guy. He was like the sixth inning guy.
It's a sometimes Jones. It's yeah, like, you know, sometimes we need Jones. You, man.
Okay. So anyway, going to the Marines, and he was lighting up. And now the guy they traded for is a 20
heavy hitter.
Is a stocky 24-year-old left-handed power hitter, a guy with a lot of raw, who basically has raw power but doesn't make contact. Mm-hmm. Doesn't hit for average, and he's hit some home runs in the Eastern League, which is a very good hitter's league. I think the key part to this trade is that Sawamura's contract was reported around, I think, 154 million yen, which is about $1.5 million. Mm-hmm. And Kotsky's contract was reported about 5.4 million yen, which is about $50,000. I think that's the trade. Basically, the Marines got a player, the Giants got a question mark, and they just took $1.5 million off their books.
See ya. To both of those things. All right.
I think he'll be good with the Marines. You know, he's going to be short term. He's going to be good with the Marines, because what you see generally is guys who get traded, they are super prepared. You know, they so want to show how good they are with their new team. They so want to show. I mean, I've seen guys who never did anything in their career as soon as they got traded. And one guy, I was working with a team, and I'm not going to mention his name, but I was working advising a team, and I said, this guy, there's no reason to believe he can play. Okay, there's no reason to believe he's ever going to hit. He's got like 1,000 minor league at bats, and he's done nothing, and he's 26 years old. Okay, so they traded him, and what does he do? Like the first 7 or 8 games, they put him on the first team, and he hits like 800, and he drives in like 6 or 7 runs. And I'm thinking, oh my god, don't do this to me. But then he went back to normal, and then within 9 months, he was back with his old team because he was released and nobody else wanted him. But that happens a lot. Guys who get traded often do really, really, really well, at least in Japan. They do really, really well right off the gun. But he does have quality. So it's not just, okay, I'm going to show him I can play once in my life. Who knows? Maybe he'll be the guy. He'll be a huge success for the Marines. I hope so.
Okay. All right. Making a one of those great one-seam transitions, we want to quickly talk about a number of guys who have revived their careers. I don't know that we have to say it that way, but because Hideaki Wakui has been pitching on the top team his entire career. So it's
but I think when you're sold, that's sort of some of my Twitter followers were saying, look, he's motivated to do well because they sold him. They didn't even want a player in return.
Right. So, we're going to start with the guy. And I didn't know that there was a comeback player of the year. I thought there was no such award in Japan, but you said that there is.
Daisuke Matsuzaka won it when he won, I think, 6 games for the Dragons 3 years ago.
Okay. Well, Hideaki Wakui of the Rakuten Eagles is one player, and Shota Dobayashi of the Hiroshima Carp is the other. So, what do you think about Wakui? Because you talked about the fact that he's mixing in more pitches. Seems like he's expanding the zone a little bit more often, and that has been a key to his success this year.
I think he's the key, really, there's two things. One is, as I said, I think a spin on his fastball is better. And I think he's been using that to be more aggressive in the strike zone. Okay, that's part one. So he's been throwing the fastball for strikes and sort of like forcing hitters to adjust to his fastball. And then he's got the same, you know, he's always had the good slider. and his splitter's a little better than it had been in the past. But I think overall the quality of his pitches are better. But I think really the key is the quality of his fastball that he's been using to set up his other pitches. You know, the quality of the fastball in the strike zone.
Okay. And what about Dobayashi?
Dobayashi is really interesting because he's, you know, he had that great start to the season when everything that came off, everything was jumping off his bat. It's almost like nobody was, all the Central League pitchers were as unprepared for him to be good as I was.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, he could always hit. But my impression of when he started his career was that he was undisciplined as a hitter.
Mm-hmm.
He would chase. He didn't know what pitches, you know, he didn't have a good approach. You know, he'd watch pitches down the pipe and then he'd chase a pitch that he shouldn't be hitting. You know, it's sort of like, he seemed to be confused. And what I've seen this year from the numbers, and I haven't watched him a lot, but from the numbers, what it looks like is he's just gradually become more disciplined, both in terms of chasing fewer pitches out of the zone
mm-hmm.
and making better and choosing the pitches he goes after in the zone better. Going after, maybe a strike, but it's a borderline strike and I don't have two strikes on me. So, you know, let it go. So that thing, and that has resulted in making a little better contact and having a better on-base percentage through the walks. But it's been a gradual progression. His plate discipline in the minors has been getting gradually better and better every year. So when I looked at his minor league numbers, I wasn't so surprised.
Okay. Yeah, he started out like a house of fire, but he has gone – his average has been sinking each month.
Yeah.
340 in July – 256 in August, and it's at 184 now, and the team is and just kind of wallowing. So he just has not seemed to be able to sustain that magic that he had earlier on. So we'll have to watch and see. Right now, well, they're not in last place, actually. The Carp are barely out of last place ahead of the Swallows.
Yeah. With Dobayashi, I think it's as much as people are able to adjust faster to him than he is to them. I think that may always have been the case. With Wakui, he's also had a couple of bad starts. He, you know, after a couple of mediocre starts to start the season, he was just on fire. And now he's had a couple of mediocre starts. But I think a few weeks ago, I was watching him pitch. I alluded to this. Oh, there we go, the word alluded to. I alluded to the fact that when Norimoto cut his hand, I was thinking it was Wakui because Wakui had been like he had a fingernail issue, like a split nail or something was bugging him because he kept like massaging his fingers on the mound late in games. And I think he might have an issue with his fingers allowing him to command the fastball. So he's not getting the same spin on it as he was, because I think he's throwing more and more straight pitches in the zone.
And that's why he's being.
I think he's getting scored upon more often. Now when he misses, it's just me.
All right, something to look out for. All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, this comes from E Flat via Twitter, and he said, "Why are so many stadiums having people sit so close together? I think they would distance them throughout the stadium, but some don't even use the outfield bleachers. # high heat." Jim,
Can I socially distance myself from that answer?
John.
Okay, no, I didn't know. I have noticed that. I have noticed stands where like the upper deck will be empty, but the lower deck will be crowded. And I have seen some stadiums. I know the Eagles have. I noticed it today when I were watching the Eagles game that they have red tape. They have like tape covering seats you're not supposed to sit in. So nobody can sit next to anybody else. Okay, so that's one. So different teams have different policies. It's up to the team. Some of them are strict and some of them are lax.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I wouldn't do it. And in fact, we got word late in the week or last week that they're going to try to up the number of fans allowed at certain stadiums or at all the stadiums nationwide. But, you know, I wouldn't do this. It's not, you know, we've talked about, we used to hear early on during the coronavirus situation and crisis, flattening the curve. And we in Tokyo, we're not getting a lot of flattening of curves. It's gone down, but it hasn't flattened. And I don't see why this is a good idea. I don't understand why more people would be okay. And it hit me the other day, maybe when I was out running, that...
Did it leave a mark?
I tried to miss it, but it fell on top. It hit me right in the coconut.
Wow.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised at all to learn that the Olympic Committee is behind some of this, that it has stepped in and said, keep up the good work. You're making a great... You're setting a great example for us for next year.
Right.
A shining example. Hint, hint. Maybe you can get some more people in there. Because it just seemed like this whole thing at the beginning of the crisis earlier in the year that NPB was ignoring it because the Olympics were still on the table for this year and no one wanted to cancel.
Yep, I agree.
And I just can't help but think that there's a link for next year as well. So that's what I'm thinking, but I wouldn't do it. I wanted to go to a game, and I thought, what am I going to go to a game for and sit next to people for and risk, you know, 3 hours of sitting next to people who are breathing? No, I'm not doing it.
You work at a newspaper. You can go to the morgue.
Yeah. But no, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Now the quick thing is that the teams have announced their attendance figures. And they're going to be, I think, from the last day of September, they're going to be allowed to have half capacity or 20,000, whichever is less. And
not me. Yeah,
right. But the Giants said, and here's the thing, the teams are coming out and saying, we don't want to be the one that's pushing the limit. So the teams that have announced their attendance, their new attendance limits are undercutting it. So the Giants could technically bring in 20,000. They said, no, we're 19,000. We're good with 19,000. I'm surprised they didn't say 19,590.
Yeah. Why don't we split right down the middle?
That's right. $1.99 is not $2.
Right.
And the Swallows have gone for, I think, 15,000, which is about 40% of their attendance. So that seems to be the thing. And the other thing, the other note, of course, is to as a note to what John said, is the this past week, the Olympics have gone from no vaccine, no safety, no Olympics to Olympics, hell or high water.
Yeah.
And so I think the timing is suspect, a lot of the timing. And as John said, a lot of the timing for NPB is basically whatever the government has had to do to say about the Olympics, NPB has fallen in line.
Definitely. Okay, one more quick one. One of your Twitter followers asked about Carter Stewart Jr., so I went straight to the horse's mouth, or fingers, as it were, since I sent him a message.
Okay. Horse, sure they were.
I thought you were going to say, your horse has no fingers, but okay. Yeah. And here's what Carter said. He said, things are going well. I'm just working on my command. And as for when he might throw on the top team, he said, honestly, I have no idea. So there you go. There's the Carter Stewart Jr. report.
All right.
Fresh from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Cliches are okay.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Anyone else who has a question or criticism or you disagree with something Jim or I said, please let us know on Twitter at JBW Podcast, on the Facebook page, or you can send us an MP3 at the email address yakyujohn@gmail.com. We will talk to you next week. When's your next live viewing event? 2 weeks from today?
I have not said it. I'll let you know next week.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later. See you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at jballallen.com.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. Be sure to send in your questions with hashtag HiHeat, and you'll hear from us again next week.